Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Recently, the Buffalo Toronto Public Media Studios held a screening of the film 100 Years from Mississippi. It's a story of Mamie Lang Kirkland, who lived to be over 100 years old. She was born in Mississippi, fled Mississippi, and eventually came to Buffalo, where she raised most of her family. She then returned to Mississippi with her son, Tarabu Kirkland, who is a filmmaker. And that, of course, is the narrative behind 100 Years from Mississippi. After the screening of the film, there was a panel discussion. It was moderated by our executive producer, Charles Gilbert. On the panel, Tarabu Kirkland, the filmmaker, Itina Farid-Cook, and Dr. Janice Ferguson. On What's Next Today, we present you that panel discussion.
So the first question, and these questions are going to be anyone can answer, jump in and answer, and then we could just go down. But the first question, the film referenced a lot of historical trauma and its intergenerational impact. Can you talk about that and the role you think storytelling plays into healing the trauma?
Yes, indeed. And I have a couple of notes here as I watched again. I thought of a couple of things. The effects of trauma linger. And we are still bearing the burden of what happened to our ancestors. I think that trauma is this constant, it's this constant throb and being over us. Based off of what we watched today, you can see that resonate throughout the film. But then also, I think about traumas that we're enduring even today. I think when I watched this, I thought about my own. I can't help but think about my own personal journey and dealing with trauma coming from a biological woman whose biological mother, who was beautiful, creative, intelligent, but had voids in her life. And due to that, my sister, brother, and I were placed into foster care. Then we dealt with traumas through that experience. And how even today, being a mother, being an educator, an entrepreneur, carrying the weight of that trauma still, and having to navigate through life and through these different spaces and arenas to deal with it. It never leaves you. You have to move and endure with that. And never let it hold you hostage. So I think I thought about that when I watched this. And then the beautiful thing that is always going to resonate for me is at the end of the film, when she says, "When I was 7, I was frightened. She's not frightened no more." It's just a beautiful thing to be released, to let go, But yeah, that's what I think of when I think of trauma in this space.
When I think of trauma, I think of the fact that we all have had trauma in our lives that different levels. When I think of Mrs. Kirkland, I think of how she had the ability to persevere and to get through. And to me, the lesson of trauma is, yes, we have to deal with it. It comes in many forms, but we can survive, we will survive. And it's people like Mrs. Kirkland who show us the example that helps us and sustains us. So that's what I remember most. That yes, there are dark times, there are many, many things that are difficult, but persevere. And her faith in God through it all, and how she, throughout the movie, just in conversation, she always referenced, you know, her strong faith. And I think that those things help us deal with trauma, and those things help us get through.
Amen. You know, we know a lot more about trauma than we did 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. In international circles, for instance, when we're dealing with refugee communities, we understand now that we have to respond to their trauma. We have to deal with their psychic burden, their emotional challenges. That didn't happen for black people fleeing the South from racial terrorism. And then they moved up north and out west into, you know, decades of ghetto and despair. There was no space to recover. There was no opportunity to talk about the anguish and the terrorism they experienced. So I think it's important that we continue to tell these stories, to classify it as an era of terrorism. Because we do a lot when we think a situation is a terrorist situation. You know, we erect monuments, went to war for it. But for black people experiencing this, you know, they just had to deal with it and move on. And so, especially now, I think, when there's this whole-scale attempt to erase history, to completely remove it from the public record, these stories are important. Because I think what you see that's happening right now with these memory laws, as I call them, is an attempt to control our memory. Tell us what we can think about. Politicians using the power of the state to tell us what books we can read. And more importantly, how we can understand the truth about our country. So these stories are a way of us for keeping that story alive. And it's important to keep that in the public record.
I think it's important also that we have a responsibility of telling the stories. If we don't tell it, it won't get told.
Yeah.
And so we definitely have to make sure that we tell the story and we tell it truthfully.
Yes.
I completely agree. Now, during this film, there's a lot of stuff about, you know, us re-remembering our history. And I know for me personally, when the What's Next team had traveled to Charleston, we traveled to Charleston, South Carolina, and I remember going to Sullivan Island, which, you know, for those who are not familiar, Sullivan Island is the last spot that slaves were before they were auctioned off. So I bring all that up to ask the question of how does memory inform us, particularly as we re-remember each time we visit a story, a lesson from our past?
Well, I think memory becomes our pathway to liberation. Because it informs us of what we should not repeat. That's why I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for the Jewish community, keeping the story of the Holocaust alive. But it's also why it's so painfully devastating to witness what's going on in Gaza today, because we need to learn from history and not repeat its disastrous effects. We need to learn from it so we can get stronger from it, be better caretakers of our communities, but not fall into that trap where we repeat what's harmful. So our memory is our teacher, hopefully, but tragically not always.
The other thing that came out in the movie that Mrs. Kirkland reminded us of, things happen over and over and over again. And so it's how we deal with the experience and going forward. Because throughout her life, she was constantly challenged. She said, this is just like, you know, Mississippi, or I've experienced this again. So it's not a one-time kind of thing. It's a life experience, especially if you're an African-American living now in this country. We can all identify with tragedy. We can all identify with some experience that made us feel less than, or we weren't treated right. So it is our responsibility to make sure, number one, that we're aware of the story and we tell the story.
One of the things that I think of when dealing with memory, no matter how painful it is what it is. And a lot of times, I'm speaking like as a mother, we sometimes try to hold back on the very difficult stories that we need to share with the hopes that we might save our children from the reality of tragedies, trauma, or what have you, when realistically, we're holding them back from experiencing the truth. And I feel like regardless of how heavy it is, regardless of how difficult it is to watch, because it is difficult to watch that, you know, it's difficult to see, like I wrote a note, 2,000 bullets into a body that hung. And I said, hearing that leads me to hear Nina Simone's Strange Fruit. Mm-hmm. And even in her creating that song, it pushes you to remember. It creates a visual for you to see those hanging from the poplar tree. And though that's heavy and people don't want to hear it, and it's like, oh, you know, but that happened then, but it happened. And it needs to be told. And yes, when we tell those stories, especially for the next generation, the hope is that they'll carry that. They don't forget where we came from. And also with memory in telling these stories, one of the things as I was sitting back there watching it again, I felt proud. And I felt like, should I feel proud? Yes, indeed. Because look at how far our people have come. To go through all of this that we've gone through, to still sit in this space today and to be educated and to run businesses and to have families and to be financially stable and to stand on our own too, like we should always be proud. Just because we're sharing the stories doesn't mean we need to sit and say, oh, you know, woe is me. No. We should be proud because your mother is a beautiful essence, a beautiful gem, you know? She should always be remembered, and everyone, you know, that have lived that life and experienced those things. So that's what I think of when I think of memory.
Now, in the film, there was as I was preparing for this, there was something that she said that makes me think of the future. When she, you know, said that the assistant minister had said that you've done something to help these young people. And what does this documentary inspire hope for the future generations in the fight for racial justice? And what was it about Mamie's life journey resonates most with you?
How much time do we have?
Well, I was going to say, Janice looked like something lit up in her.
Well, all of it. You know, number one, when you think about the fact that she was 15 years old when she got married, 15. And then she ended up coming to Buffalo, 1924, I think it was. 24. And she really didn't have any of her family here at first, but she persevered. It was her strength. And the fact that she always wanted to be an English teacher, but she didn't have the opportunity, but yet her knowledge and her experience and how she was able to communicate with everyone far surpassed any degree she may have been able to get. So I was just very, very impressed with Mrs. Kirkland's ability, her character, her strength, and her determination. She's a very, very strong woman. And throughout everything, that was very, very clear to me. So that's what resonated.
Interestingly, too, 1925, the year after she got here, mm-hmm. Was the largest Ku Klux Klan rally ever in Buffalo, New York. Mm. So she had just left.
Really?
You know, the violent South to come up north to right. witness a Ku Klux Klan right. rally. You know, I think it's important that we hear authentic survivor stories, especially now when we are confronted with so much misinformation. Because generationally, we have so many powerful stories in our communities. And we need to continue to tell those stories and publicize those stories, because we got to where we are through the wisdom of our elders. And that's a piece that I think we can take forward and should take forward. The other thing that I think is that, you know, when she decided to make this journey to confront this trauma and this past, she was already 107 years old. So it demonstrates that you are never too old to do justice work. You are never too old to do good, you know. And I think she also realizes that her story, which is a family story told around the kitchen table, was connected to a much larger story, a much larger context that was connected to this whole legacy of slavery. And that her story was a part of that story. Her voice was a part of that telling of this history. It was a very powerful thing to witness, especially firsthand to see that blossoming happen. So it was inspiring, and I think it should inspire folks to, you know, continue to raise their voices, because we need to do it now. Y'all can't be quiet out there. There's no time to be quiet right now, because this is going to affect all of us.
But you know, you said something too that is important. Oftentimes when we are traumatized, we don't want to talk about right. it. We don't want to deal with it because right. it's so painful. So that's part of the balance we're trying to.
I think so. I mean, I think about my grandfather who she mentioned when he fled Mississippi fearing for his life. He didn't talk about it for the remainder of his life.
A lot of times.
I mean, that's a lot of pain, buried down, explosive. That's what causes our disease in a lot of cases.
And there are a lot
we don't deal with it.
A lot of untold stories yeah. because of that.
Yes.
I was going to add that there's freedom in sharing stories. Mm-hmm. It can be a lot. It can be weighty, but there's freedom in it. Just living out loud authentically and not being afraid to express that. And you don't have to share every single piece of detail, but at least share that, you know, overall story so that others can kind of live with you, you know, with it. The other thing, as far as the younger generation, every single person in here is the younger generation under her. So she has affected every single one of you, and myself included, by just sharing the story. And then you bringing it to us. You know, and just using film in order to keep that story going is remarkable as well.
I agree. I completely agree. So as we are celebrating International Women's Month, why do you think stories like Mamie's are often left out of mainstream history? How do we change that?
Wow. Well, I don't know about everybody out there, but I went through my entire primary, secondary, and even college education, and there was almost no mention of slavery, except for one, until I got to college and took a class from Professor Jesse Nash, which many of you know and remember, with my colleague out there, Leroy Johnson. So, you know, excuse me. This was an incredible journey that we went through, and an incredible transformation. I hope you saw it in the film how much she changed from the time these conversations started, because this film went on for maybe 15 or 20 years. I was filming long before this film even became an idea. So I was able to capture those moments on camera where she was like don't even talk to me about Mississippi. I ain't going there. I don't want to hear it, you know. And the conversion to her accepting that took a long time. So it's funny today when you know the line that's put out there is that if you teach a truer history of America to our children, they will grow up not to love their country. That's the argument. You can't teach this history because the kids will grow up hating their country. So it's interesting because if we try to erase from history the difficult parts of our past, that's not patriotism. That's propaganda. Yeah. So I think the actual opposite is true. I think if we teach children this history, they will actually grow up and want to correct the wrongs and do something positive about it. So I think we have to be brave enough to continue to tell the stories, because Janice is right. If we don't tell our stories, who will? I got a little off topic there, Charles. Excuse me.
You're fine.
I just want to add but share my thoughts as far as when you were talking about why are these stories, you basically said, why are these stories not being told or could be not shared? I think it's to your point, the more that we don't share, the absence of an understanding of a truth, which then causes a lot of young people or younger generations. And when I say young people, I'm not talking about just like 8-year-olds and teenagers. I'm talking about like us, the young, you know, this generation. We will have a hard time having a connection to our ancestors, but we'll have a difficult time with identity. I can't help but just think about the way that I dealt with my own personal life. Being separated or displaced from my biological family and not knowing them, or, you know, I knew of them, but not knowing them, knowing meaning experiencing and being around them, regardless of, you know, the difficulties that they're facing, the negativity that may have occurred, and the things that have happened. But growing up with the absence of knowing made it difficult for me to understand who I wanted to be, who I am going to be, what am I going to do, who do I look to? I looked in the mirror, I looked just like my biological mother, but who is she? No one told the stories until I got older. When I got older, I began to realize how intelligent my mother was. And so that juxtaposed to hearing your mother had issues with drugs, or your mother did this, or your mother did that, or your father wasn't around. Me learning, and regardless whether you're telling me the good or the bad, give it all to me so that I can decide who I'm going to be in this life. And I think that that's what we need to do with our younger generation. Stop sugarcoating things to try to save them from the truth. They need to hear the truth so that they at least have it and decide what are they going to do with it, you know?
Can I add just one other thing to that?
Yes.
Because you referenced something that made me think about. Let us not forget that we are still in this country stuck in this denial philosophy. It's a philosophy of denial. And so there's always this talk about getting to the next place, getting to reconciliation. Well, you cannot have reconciliation until you have truth. So if you're in denial of truth, it's going to make it real difficult to reconcile anything. you can't go there until you like acknowledge what has happened. And so we have a problem with that in this country.
I would like to add responsibility. We have a responsibility to make sure that, number one, we know our story, we know what happened, and we have a responsibility of making sure that that information is shared, not only with the younger generation, all people. If our story isn't right, then who corrects it? We have that responsibility of making sure that we know the story and we tell it. And so that's what I look to going forward. There will always be the case where people will try to make it different or whatever, but that does not remove the fact that we first have that responsibility of making sure that we know and that we tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
And using, if I may, just add as well, the use of media, I typed, we type now. The use of media as a tool of influence to control the minds of the people, to sway them in a direction that benefits one side or idea, and it also is used to further divide us as human beings. So the very media that was used during that time frame where it made a certain people be afraid of black men because the idea that they would rape white women, that media is still used today. Absolutely. And if we are placed in a position of those who know and understand the truths, like what you did, you use digital storytelling in order for us to hear the truth and to see the truth. During that time, could you only imagine being on that other side and seeing in the media that one voice saying you should be afraid? Those individuals, all they could do is be afraid, because there's not an opposing side telling the truth to say, actually, this is not the truth. There's no other side of it, so that we can come together and kind of like, okay, well, let's cancel that out. That's wrong. But there was nothing to fight against that falsity or that, you know, that lie. So using media, using our tools, using our influences to combat against the lies that are being told. And it's still being used today. Media, social media, music is being used to lie and infiltrate our young people, to make them think certain things in certain ways. We have to get control of it and start telling the truth.
Amen.
So, two more questions, and then we will hopefully get Q&A from you guys. But this question is particularly directed towards you, Turbo, and Janice. Turbo, if your mother were here today, what do you think she would say about the current state of racial justice in America?
Ooh. Well, I think she has some very choice words for that man with the funny hair. And I think she'd be reflecting deeply about experiences that she went through and the recent past from George Floyd. And I think she'd be deeply concerned about where this country is at right now. But I also think she would not succumb to despair. And she would encourage people to never give up, to keep their joy and keep fighting, because that's what her spirit was about. So I think she would be in that place.
I think she would, as she demonstrated in the film, she would tell us to never give up, that this, you know, we can handle this, we should handle this. I think she had a heart full of grace and a soul full of just confidence. And so I think that she would expect us to make sure that we don't give up. She would also expect for us to tell the story. I mean, she would think that this would be something that we would be doing, that we would be taking care of our own. One of the things about Mrs. Kirkland that I always loved was how family-oriented she was and what she poured into her family, and how you know, many of her children went on and received higher degrees and are very involved in community and everything else. This is something that she valued. So things that she valued, you know, in addition to education, raising a family, and her spiritual life, her belief in God, these were all the things that made her the strong person that she was. So if she were sitting here, she would say, don't give up. You know, you have to do this. And she would encourage us to make sure that we continue to fight.
Yeah, if I can just thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Share, one of the most uplifting things that we've heard, and we've shown this film all over the country, is that people were amazed with how she maintained her positive and generous spirit towards people after experiencing this devastating history. And there's this quote, I don't know if I can remember it correctly, by the late great Bell Hooks, where she says, how can we hold people accountable for their wrongdoing, yet at the same time remain in contact enough with their humanity to allow them the space to be transformed? That's a hell of a question. But also, I think in that question, it's more than a political challenge, because you can't respond to a question like that just on a intellectual or political level. It's a spiritual challenge.
It is.
Right?
It is, yeah.
That is a deep, deep spiritual challenge. And she was able to, you know, despite that history, she was able to talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. She was able to empathize with them, hear their story, and have compassion. How simple that sounds, but so difficult to do. So I think inherent in that is, like, she would, like, you got to do the spiritual work too. She didn't have a lot of educational degrees, mm-hmm. but she was enormously studied spiritually.
She was.
She was a rock spiritually. So I think she would also say, you know, you got to do the spirit work too. You can't just respond to this politically.
Right.
Do the work on your soul. That's incumbent upon all of us, regardless of who we are. That's the journey that we have to take in this incarnation.
Absolutely.
Do the spirit work.
The other thing I would add is that I was impressed as a woman how she constantly was engaged in things. I mean, later after she lost her husband and she decided she was gonna sell Avon. So she was traveling, you know, all over the city. So I whispered and I said, did your mother ever drive? And the answer was, no. She said that's how she got her exercise, and she walked all over the city. So I think it was not only her strong faith, it was that she wasn't comfortable in not doing something and not being engaged. And I also love when you were talking about the Avon, when she said, oh, no, I don't need a computer. I'll figure this out all by myself. And so that example of, you know, doing good and continuing to reinvent and to make yourself purposeful, I think, is a wonderful legacy that she left us.
Final question. We are in a pivotal moment in history. What do we do now? And what are some actions and recommendations you would suggest communities consider at this time in history?
That's a hefty question. To be honest, I'm a firm believer in this idea of having a human first mindset, loving people. For me, I just want to love God and love people, right?
Amen.
One of the things that she said that stood out the most is that she never had anger towards white people, no issue with color, bad people and good people. What good would that do me? You a person and I'm a person. Mm-hmm. What do? We do the best that we can with what we have. I think for me, understanding the talents, gifts, and skills that I have, the education, both lived and learned. In what ways do I utilize that to support my community? If I focus on that, focus on, you know, this idea of focused from my company, F-O-K-U-S-D is how I spell it. F being the foundation. What's your values and beliefs built on? For me, it's faith. God is the foundation because it is unchangeable. I can always rely on him. There's nothing changing there. The O is the optimism. Glass half full. The K is the knowledge, lived and learned. How do I utilize my knowledge to help my people? My people meaning all people. The U is being unwavering, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of what's happening, coming from a city that's deemed to be one of the poorest and growing up on a side of the city that's deemed to be one of the poorest. But okay, and I'm still going to flourish, unwavering, and being strategic and dedicated. We utilize these, or for myself, I utilize these principles, not only those, but those that are in the Bible, and I continue to love God and love people. Now, of course, you can go on this other space of, you know, building initiatives, and that's important as well, and creating, you know, opportunities for other people. You can do that as well, but it starts with you. It starts in here. It starts with your foundation. And then from there, you're supposed to go and grow. So that's my mindset on what do we do now. Take care of you and let that outgrowth happen.
So I was, I came of age in the 60s. So I'm an affirmative action child. Along with my colleague Roy Johnson, we were the first cohort of black students at Canisius College in 1967. And so when we got there, was it less than 10 black students there? So the first thing we did was walk into the president's office, lock the door for several hours and say, we ain't leaving until you get some more black students in here. So I come from the activist model of the 60s. So we gotta stay informed, but not overwhelmed. I mean, I talk to so many people, it's like, I can't watch the news, it's too toxic. I get it. It really is toxic, but we gotta stay informed. We have to stay informed, we gotta share truthful, factual information with our families, with our friends, with our community members. We got to be a mouthpiece for truth and justice. We got to organize. You got to speak up. You got to make public comment. You know, we got to do all those. We got to donate to progressive causes. You know, there's a lot of actions going around the country. I think there's a big postcard writing campaign that's happening this Saturday on the 15th. You know, we got to participate. So I think we need to do everything we can, you know, from organizing to, you know, mass disobedience to protest, whatever.
I just feel like saying ditto, because really it does start with us individually, then it starts with our families, it starts within our community, and it's all the things, and then connecting with community support groups that are doing things. I was thinking about Mrs. Kirkland when she came to Buffalo in 1924. Mm-hmm. There were 5,000 black people in the city of Buffalo, and most of them lived in the Ellicott district. Right. But that district, there was a positive side to it. I don't want us to leave not thinking about that. There were 15 black churches then. There were organizations that received people coming in from the South and helping them. The churches played a large role. There were newspapers. There was print then. As a matter of fact, one of the Criterion was there, was in operation then. So the point is, we need to make sure that we're supporting within our community, too, the things that we want to push forward, because that's also, but it's different levels that we have to make sure that we're engaged in if we want to bring about a change.
You've been listening to a panel discussion held in the Buffalo Toronto Public Media Studios following the screening of the film 100 Years from Mississippi. That panel included filmmaker Tarabu Kirkland, Itina Farid-Cook, and Dr. Janice Ferguson. It was moderated by the executive producer of What's Next, Charles Gilbert. And Charles is here with us in studio to talk a little bit more about 100 Years from Mississippi. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's weird, per se, to be, you know, sitting across from you in the studio, not being in the control room, yelling, not yelling, but telling you, giving you cues and everything.
You're out of control for the next 10 minutes here, and are the source of our discussion. I want to get into a lot of things, but first of all, let's talk about the film. We heard a little bit in the panel discussion, obviously some different opinions and perspectives and some of the issues that were raised. But what about for you? What stood out in the film?
Mamie's overall position on life, her view on life. You know, growing up in the Deep South, growing up in Mississippi, having to deal with all the racism and injustice going down there, and throughout her whole life, she didn't have anything negative to say about, you know, white people.
Okay.
Like, she even said it, you know, she doesn't hate people. You know, we are all people. Like, she was doing a gesture when she was like touching her hand. It was like, we're the same. You know, I have love for everybody. Despite going through what she went through, going through and experiencing and seeing the things that she's seen, her father having to flee and then the man that was with him then coming back to Mississippi, getting lynched. And the story about that lynching, and she had no ill will, no malice towards anybody.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, we rely on you in a lot of ways when it comes to the east side of Buffalo. You grew up, of course, on the east side, went to school here in the city of Buffalo. And I'm wondering, Mamie Lang Kirkland, you're saying she didn't have malice for anybody. White people didn't matter, even though these atrocities were committed and forced her family to flee. Do you think that represents the overall attitude of the east side, or is this an exceptional person who just has found a certain type of forgiveness in her heart?
I think it's in a lot of black people's hearts. Like, at the end of the day, we forgive because it's just always in our nature to do that. I know some will not. You know, we've had people on the show that have said they will not forgive what happened on May 14th. I know people who won't forgive stuff that has happened across the nation. But the overall premise of it, when you think about our ancestors and you think about how they were just still willing to forgive, because it's, in a sense, is what, like, God would want us to do.
Good point.
So when we, and it's kind of tricky because, like, you know, everything that happened on 514, and then you have people like saying, like, is there people that have forgiven him for what he did? Some do, some don't.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I feel like it's in us as people to forgive, because that's what God would want us to do.
Take us inside the screening now. It was a good audience, large audience that we had in our BTPM studios. Did you watch what the audience was doing? Did you get a sense of how they were following along with this film, what the reaction was?
When we were sitting, because I was in the crowd when the screening was taking place. So I was in the crowd and I'm watching everything. And there's some, because there was some things that Mamie said that was, that, you know, you chuckled at.
Okay.
You know, like she opened it up when she mentioned the funny man with, the man with the funny hair.
Okay.
And then it goes right to President Trump. So people like chuckled about that. Sure. People chuckled about how when she was selling Avon, and you heard it in the panel discussion where Janice was saying that she talked to Rabu and said, like, your mother really didn't want to use a, like, she didn't want to drive. She wanted to use a computer. Like, why? She didn't want to drive because she said that was her daily exercise, her walking house to house. And then doing the filing and everything, she did that manually and not through a computer because she didn't want to. And then it was something else that she said that got people to laugh. But then, you know, there is the moments of silence. You know, there's moments of people like just like gasping and being like, oh, like it's just, it's hard to see what she is talking about. And Rabu did a fabulous job at displaying the story. Hmm. And then there's the triumph. There's her going back to Mississippi. Then there's the her going to the museum in Mississippi. And just seeing how she was just lit up with, in a sense, with joy, because it's like, wow, I'm back here. I didn't expect that I would come back. And then you get that little small glimmer of, I don't want to say conflict, but it's like, she's, I really don't want to, don't bring it up to me. But then starts to, okay, maybe let me, maybe God wants me to go back. And then she eventually goes back. And the audience was very in tune with the story, especially because it has roots here, obviously.
Right.
So, and whenever you have something that has roots to the location, it kind of, you get more of that interaction with the audience.
I want to talk a little bit about the roots or explore it just for a moment here. Of course, as we mentioned, Turabu Kirkland is the son of Mamie Lane Kirkland. He's the filmmaker for 100 Years from Mississippi. You got to sit on the panel with him and moderate, but at the same time, you also talked to one of his sisters, right?
As when the show was over, the panel discussion, everything was over, and everybody was getting ready to leave, she happened to come up to me. It was one of his sisters, and she was talking to me and Sylvia Bennett, and she was explaining to us how her kids never met their grandmother. But whenever they, because they heard stories about her, so whenever there was something of racial injustice or something going on, they would go to her and say, what would grandma say? What would grandma do? But what threw me for the curveball was, as I was looking at her, she looked just like Mamie.
Wow.
Like, it was though as if Mamie just came off the screen and was just right there, you know? And it just, it blew me away, you know, because there are, when you look at certain relatives, it's like, you look just like that person. And it's though as if that spirit has been passed on to that offspring or relative or whatever the case may be. So it was, I got a little goosebumps when I seen her. Right. But It was an incredible little small conversation that I had with her.
Let's maybe just get a couple of thoughts about each of the panelists. So we'll start with Dr. Janice Ferguson. I don't know Dr. Ferguson. You got a chance, though, of course, to sit on the panel or moderate the panel. What did Janice Ferguson bring to the discussion?
Well, she knew her. She knew okay. Mamie. So there was more of that insight of the personal, I know her. Like, they was even talking about being, you know, in the green room when we were just waiting, just getting those personal stories about her and Mamie's relationship and her relationship with Turabu and things like that. So she brought that insight of the person, not like the mother, like how Turabu, that's his mom. So his vision is more, that's my mother.
Yeah.
She's more like, that's a friend. I know her personally. I had these personal stories with her. So,
and then since you just kind of brought it up about Turabu, I mean, the film's long produced, you know, he has seen it more than literally any other human being in the world. At the same time, here he is talking about this. Was he, how would you describe his, the way he carried himself? Was he emotional at times about this?
He got emotional when the question, and you can hear it. You can hear it in his voice when he's talking and he, you know, got quiet and said, excuse me for a moment. Mm. And you can tell, like, right then, I can tell this is emotional for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the youngest. I can relate. Right. I can relate all the way.
Yeah, baby,
the bond that you see between the two of them in the film, but when he speaks about her, you can feel that bond. Mm. You can feel that love and how he just cared about the story and wanted to make sure that this continues to go on. Her legacy continues to be heard. And as long as, and I told him this, that as long as, you know, he's still living, as long as the family still remembers her legacy, it will continue to live on.
And Itina Fareed Cook, of course, is part of this as well. Buffalo Poet Laureate. We interviewed her on this program before she was the Poet Laureate, because, I mean, she's a multimedia artist, really extraordinary, but a poet as well. I think any place that Itina Fareed Cook is, she brings a special quality to. But what about for a panel discussion like this?
I mean, she's an artist. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
When she's watching this, she's taking her notes, she's putting together quotes and artistic expression for things like that. Like, she, in the discussion, she referred to Nina Simone, Strange Fruit, because when they talk about the man that was lynched, all she thought about was Strange Fruit hanging from the tree. And she incorporated that, and then she brought in her, you know, her beliefs and her values to the conversation, which is always incredible when you have someone like Itina on.
Absolutely. Well, Charles, it has been great having you on What's Next. Of course, you've hosted this program and have produced it now for over a couple of years. But thanks very much for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
We've been talking about 100 Years from Mississippi, the film about Mamie Lang Kirkland, and the panel discussion that was held here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media. It featured Turabu Kirkland, the son of Mamie Lang Kirkland, and also the filmmaker of 100 Years from Mississippi, Itina Fareed Cook and Dr. Janice Ferguson, and it was moderated by our executive producer, Charles Gilbert. This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.